I'm Kate Remington. I'm talking with Rebecca Miller. She'll be conducting the New Haven Symphony Orchestra on Thursday evening, March 22nd in Woolsey Hall. She's one of the candidates for the position of music director. And Rebecca, it's wonderful to have a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, well, it's great to speak to you.
You've chosen a really interesting, very Russian program, the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony and the Shostakovich Cello Concerto with Nicholas Kanellakis, and In the Steppes of Central Asia from Borodin. So we'll talk about all of those and how you put that program together. But right off the bat, I'm curious about what it is about the New Haven Symphony that got you excited to apply for the position and then, you know, come and conduct.
Well, I've heard very good things about the orchestra. I know, of course, about Yale and you know, its importance. It's a wonderful educational institution that's there. And I know a few people who are sort of based at Yale, mostly a friend of mine, Aaron J. Kernis, who is a composer who I've worked with quite closely over the past few years, and just heard good things. So I thought I'd throw my hat in the ring. And you know, you never know until you meet an orchestra and an orchestra meets you, and whether there's that sort of chemistry. So it's hard to tell from paper, internet, what something's going to feel like anyway, and what a city's going to feel like. So you take your best guess, I suppose, from what it looks like on paper, and do a bit of research about the orchestra and what their visions are and where they've been and where they want to go and those sorts of things. So it seemed like a really interesting position and a very interesting organization.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I've heard from other conductors, it's a lot like having a sports car to drive, because all of the players are so very good. And so they're up for whatever you might want to throw at them. So.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, I get a sense, you know, at least I haven't met the orchestra yet, but I've talked a little bit with the committee, even over Skype at my Skype interview. And I had a feeling that it was an organization that really embraced innovation and change, and I mean, they didn't want to, you know, completely throw everything out the window. They want to keep their traditions and things, but it seemed to be an organization that really wanted new ideas and welcomed those ideas, which is not the case for all orchestras around the world today. Some of them just want to stay where they are, and that's fine. But I think the classical music world is we can't continually have to reinvent the wheel, not just on stage. Actually, we do have to reinvent the wheel every time we perform these, you know, classical pieces that people know, again, they know very well, and we have to, you know, every time I go back to a piece that I've conducted before, I have to re-examine it, I have to re-study it, I have to start from scratch, and we have to continually reinvent. And I think as organizations as well, orchestras and choirs, bands and things like this, we have to continually ask ourselves about our relevance to the world today, and continually remind people that we are relevant, and that even though this music was written 200 odd years ago, that it is still completely relevant today.
Oh, absolutely. And I know it certainly seems like, from looking at your repertoire list and the recordings that you've made and the other concerts that you've conducted through the years, you're a real advocate for music that's being written in our own time. And I think that in itself is a way of staying relevant when you show audiences, or you can demonstrate to them, that here's this tradition that's hundreds of years old, and yet it's being reinvented by all of these incredible contemporary composers.
Yes, I have worked with quite a lot of contemporary composers. I mean, actually, it's slightly strange for me that this program doesn't include anything contemporary on it. It was slightly circumstantial how this program ended up being. It was changed from what originally was suggested, but we can talk about that a bit later. But yes, I do have a strong interest in music that's being written today. I, of course, have my own tastes and likes and dislikes and things like that, but I've worked with a number of different composers who, yes, are re-examining the meaning of a melody and are not afraid to use, you know, sort of tonal harmonies anymore, but use them in a completely new way. So there was a time when those things were sort of forbidden and put under the table and said, you're not allowed to write a melody. That's not what we're doing these days. But I am a sucker for a good melody. So I do enjoy this sort of movement of contemporary music that's coming back, where it's, you know, it seems accepted and it's okay to write melodies again.
Yeah. Michael Torkey is a friend of mine, and he's written some amazing things, and he kind of changed direction too, because he said, you know, what's wrong with writing music that people like and writing music that doesn't necessarily challenge them and, you know, really make it difficult for them to listen to. So I think it's great that the pendulum is swinging back. And I think that in itself is getting a lot of people excited about contemporary music. So I think it's fantastic that you have made that a part of kind of your mission as a conductor.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think it's part of our job as well. I mean, I enjoy it, but I do see that, we need to be advocates for composers. We need to put that music out there, and the audience will ultimately, not one audience, but audiences over the years will ultimately decide which pieces are, going to be remembered. Just like there's a lot of forgotten music from past centuries that was aired and put out there, and obviously it didn't sort of stick, but I do see it as part of my job as a conductor.
Yeah, and you've also been a real advocate for music by women composers too, Ethel Smith, and then contemporary composer Judith Weir, Amy Beach, and has that been a particular mission for you all along as a conductor?
No, in fact, I used to be repulsed by the idea of doing a piece just because it was a woman. I used to think this is a ridiculous concept, but now I actually see that there is such an imbalance in the gender in both composition and in, on the podium as well, in terms of women conductors, women composers, that it's just not happening on its own. And it's ridiculous to me how male dominated the world still is, because there's so much great music out there by women. So I've just decided in the last couple of years to try to set my mind to, can I find as an opening piece, or can I find as one piece on this program, a piece by a woman that works? Now, it's not a requirement. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I end up doing a program of all male music. I don't find that repulsive now. But I think that mindset of just saying, can I think of a woman first? And then if not, so be it. And most of my programs that I've put on for the next couple of seasons that I've looking forward are integrating women composers. There's just so much good music out there. I've recorded the Amy Beach Piano Concerto, which is a piece that I absolutely adore. I think it should be part of the main canon of piano concerto repertoire. It is, in my opinion, as good as Brahms' Second Piano Concerto, on which it is based. It is a substantial 35-minute four-movement work, which she based upon the Brahms, and I think it's equally as good. But it's not imitating anything. It's really her own voice, and her story is very impressive as well. That she was really suppressed by her parents and by her husband. She married an elder gentleman who really controlled her performance and her composition career with a very, very tight rope. And until his passing, she didn't really feel the freedom, and she was released from her cage and was able to perform again and to compose. So I find her story really inspiring as well. But as you mentioned, Ethel Smythe, I'm programming next year. Dorothy Howell is another British composer that nobody really knows very much of. She was performed extensively at the BBC Proms by Henry Wood, and then sort of disappeared into second drawer or whatever. But it's really, there's some top drawer music there. So her piano concerto is on that disc as well with Amy Beach. And we sort of accidentally stumbled upon that. And I'm so glad that I found her, because I'm doing several projects of her music in the coming seasons as well. Well, so yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm wondering if you're finding that the climate has changed and it is more encouraging for women composers these days than it was even, 15 or 20 or 50 years ago.
Yes, I think the climate in those terms is more acceptable. It is still very difficult. It is not easy. I do feel like somehow this time round there is more of a groundswell. There are more organizations who are signing up to say, yes, we're gonna also change our mindset. We're gonna try to have 50-50 gender balance by such, 2020 or something. I mean, several organizations have joined on this. There's the latest initiative over here that And I think even the BBC Proms has committed to that, whether it's in their programming. I think it's in their programming of women composers. So yes, more organizations seem to be getting on board. And the more that those organizations get on the board, then I think there will be change. But it does take a lot of time. And it is not easy for the women composers. I think you just, you know, as people say about women conductors, you sort of have to be twice as good. And then you're in this position of only getting compared to other women conductors or women composers. And actually, you just want that word to disappear.
Right.
And say, you know, I know there are other women conductors, aren't there? And I, you know, and they compare you to those people. But actually, you know, we should all just be compared to each other.
Right, exactly. A level playing field. And my second year of music school, I thought I wanted to be a conductor. And it was I got a very negative attitude. I mean, I was one of only two women in the class. And just for a whole year, I was steadily sort of told in no uncertain terms that it was going to be really, really hard. And clearly you stuck it out because you've had an incredible career. But what was it like for you starting out as a conductor in music school and then later as you were trying to get your career going?
Well, it hasn't been easy, but I don't think it's an easy career for anybody. I mean, I think it is especially difficult for women. You know, maybe somebody was trying to give you a warning. I like to think that was an optimistic gesture, but it's. I'm sorry to hear that because I mean, I was quite lucky with my start that I grew up in California and I grew up in Santa Cruz, and just so happened that at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where my mom is a professor, there was a wonderful woman conductor who had just taken on the job there, and she was just taking the whole place by storm, a little fireball, and a wonderful personality. And she was my first conducting teacher. And of course, I never thought about the fact that she was a woman. It just never occurred to me. But of course, I was growing up in a liberal, very, very liberal town, California, that, you know, where gender and race and you know, it was probably a little bit of a bubble I was brought up in. It was not quite the real world, but looking back on it now, I'm so thankful that the first person that I had conducting lessons with was a woman, because I'm actually not sure that it would have occurred to me to continue if I'd not just had that role model in front of me. And I mean, I don't know, one can never know exactly what would have happened if circumstances had been different. But I'm sure that having a role model there made it seem somehow more possible for me. And they're the first, you know, several years that I was a conductor, again, the whole gender issue never really came into it. I went off to Oberlin Conservatory of Music as a pianist. And again, that's a very liberal place. And the gender issue wasn't really being talked about then. I only started to think about it when journalists started to ask me sort of, what does it feel like to be a woman conductor? And, you know, I think I never know what it's like to be a male conductor, so I can't really compare. But when I moved over to the UK in sort of 1999, 2000, there seemed to be a kind of buzz about women conductors, and oh, it's so exciting, and isn't this wonderful? There are more that are coming out of conservatories, and then the whole issue kind of went away again. I think because there wasn't really any positive action taken, and now I feel there is another surge of movement towards it. But the more role models that are out there, the more women conductors there will be. That is quite clear. I think that's just evident. And of course, positive action has to be taken in the right way. Nobody wants to get a job because of their gender, or not get a job because of their gender. But if positive action is taken in the right way with intelligence, then I think it can really make the groundswell of change move forward.
Yeah, I think so too. And I don't know, makes the future seem really interesting ahead and very much more equal, which is fantastic. And
well, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, let's get around to talking about the program, because you've chosen some really great examples of Russian music, each one very different, in the Steppes of Central Asia. And then, as I mentioned, the Shostakovich First Cello Concerto and the Tchaikovsky Fourth. So how did this program come about?
We were asked as candidates to program an entire season, which was a great exercise, of course, for a candidate to take part in, and very difficult, of course, because you don't know the orchestra, you don't know the audience, you don't know, all you know is a little bit about what you can find out about their programming history, and then the certain parameters that they surrounded you with about, you know, the number of musicians and the number of services that you can use per year. And so there were 8 programs, I think, that we put together, and this was one of them. And they asked us then to sort of choose a couple that we might like to have chosen if we were moved forward to the finalist position. And actually, this program originally had a piece, it was originally the board and the Tchaikovsky were on there, but as the concerto, it was Aaron Kernis's Dream Songs.
Oh, wow.
For cello and orchestra, which is a very different looking program, and a piece that I've just recorded. It's just come out actually last month on CD with several of other of Aaron's concertos, a viola concerto and a concerto just for orchestra. And so that was the original shape of this program. And as it turned out, the dates, you know, it's a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, how a season is put together with soloists and conductors. And it's an even bigger jigsaw puzzle when you have music director candidates coming in and people's availability. So unfortunately, the Kernis wasn't going to be possible, but the Shostakovich slotted in there quite nicely to make a sort of Russian program. And actually, the pieces slot together very nicely, but they do actually highlight differences between them as well. So the Tchaikovsky is such a popular work, but it's such a difficult work as well. It's such a difficult work to study, because as a conductor, I can feel his pain looking at these notes. If you've read his letters, this was a commission, and he had a patroness called Nadezhda von Meck, with whom they only saw each other sort of once, but they had this years and years of intense correspondence between them, and basically they were sort of soulmates, but they never met. And so he has this kind of person that he's writing for, who is this kind of ideal person, and then he's just got over a terrible marriage with somebody who's physically next to him, but miles apart spiritually. So it's this really, really interesting sort of struggle that he's going through, and it's such a personal symphony. It's to me, it's a piece actually about composition, because he talks in his letters about, you know, his composing style, which is to have a sort of seed, a little seedling, which from which then it germinates, and it's if it's well tended, it kind of grows roots, and it flowers, and all of this. And this is exactly how this symphony sort of emerges. It has this motive at the beginning, which he very specifically in his letters calls the fate motive, and then that generates a lot of the rest of the material, but it keeps coming back and coming back and coming back. And it's a terrifying symphony, actually, because there's a lot of hope, a lot of beauty in it, but this fate motive keeps coming back and tells us that actually it's all futile, we're all going to die anyway, that's our fate. And is it really, you know, should we enjoy ourselves while we're here, or should we mourn the fact that it's all futile? So it asks a lot of questions, and it's very intense.
I can imagine. And I would think that one of the challenges with conducting it, knowing that he puts so much of his personal life into this symphony, it's got to be tough to not just wallow in it and make it sound like a soap opera, because, you know, you have to get from A to B without, you know, anguish in your own mind about how you get there.
Yes, exactly. And particularly in this symphony, which really pushed the boundaries. I mean, his first 3 symphonies remain pretty classical in terms of their structure, but this one, he really put the boat out here. The first movement lasts almost 20 minutes on some recordings, and I don't know how much I'll wallow in it, but we'll see how long my first movement lasts. But it is an immense structure to pace oneself, and yes, you can't hold on to every single note and have, you know, draw the blood out of every single note, because then it just becomes endless. So one of our biggest jobs as conductors is to have that bigger picture and to guide the orchestra from pillar to pillar, and and have that larger picture in mind, both of that particular movement, but then also you've got three other movements after this. I mean, it's quite often that this symphony feels like a gigantic symphonic poem and then followed by three little encores. but yes, that's part of our job in terms of pacing. And one of the most difficult things about the symphony, I think, is actually the pacing and not letting it get stuck and to just have a perspective on it.
Yeah, which you can do. I wonder how much perspective he had on it. But now that we have the the distance of time too, that's an interesting way to look at it. And the Shostakovich Cello Concerto, the first concerto, is challenging in its own way. I mean, it's challenging for the cellist, and Nicholas Kanellakis will be dealing with that part of it. But it's also a very demanding piece.
It is, and it also has its own kind of use of a fate motive. I mean, it's not a fate motive the way that the Tchaikovsky is, but it's interesting how these two pieces ended up next to each other, because they both have these kind of slightly obsessive recurring themes, of which the composers were slightly obsessed. I mean, Tchaikovsky was obsessed with fate and with history and the burden of all of that. And Shostakovich was obsessed with this this DSCH motive that spelled out his own name. And it's a slightly warped version of it that we hear in the cello concerto. That comes back and back and back again, and is it is a struggle against of a different type. Shostakovich continually struggled with the Soviet regime and Stalin, and even after Stalin, he still continued to struggle with the regime and the sort of, he didn't want to conform to Soviet principles of what the composers were told that they could and couldn't write, and he had an incredibly difficult time being told what to do, as most composers probably do. But he really, his life was under threat. He was continually under threat from arrest, and a lot of his music was written under great duress. So although this piece was written long after Stalin died, he was still fighting against the regime, and it has a lot of pain and struggle in it, and a lot of sort of death in the background, which was on his mind for sort of the last 20 years of his life, I think.
It has a very, I think, kind of sardonic and mocking quality to it too, and it lightens up a little bit with the slow movement, but even with that, you're right, it has a very dark quality to it. So it's going to be a pretty emotional evening, it sounds like.
It will. I mean, I think the Shostakovich has slightly cooler emotional. I think one has to go at it with a slightly different kind of struggling attitude. But yes, and through melody, Tchaikovsky manages to sweep us away with him. It shouldn't be all doom and gloom. I mean, there is quite a lot of hope. There is even some humor in the Tchaikovsky, and there's even humor in the Shostakovich, although of a sort of more sarcastic and satirical humor.
Yeah.
And there's some real beauty in the Shostakovich as well. The slow movement is incredible. These melodies and then that fades into the cadenza, which is one of the longest cadenzas. The orchestra has to sit there in total concentration with the cellist in this long third movement, which is entirely comprised of this cadenza, and then heading into this very, very sarcastic last movement, intense. So yes, it's they're two incredibly intense pieces. Two pieces that I absolutely adore, though. And so for the first piece, I'm quite glad that we have a sort of slightly reflective, calm beginning to the concert, which I hope will just really serve to separate us from the outside world and just bring us into the world of the concert hall, so that people can just forget about whatever their day was like, whatever's going on outside. It's just a beautiful opening, this Borodin. It was initially intended to be one of the several tableaux to celebrate the silver anniversary of the reign of Alexander II of Russia, who was well known for having expanded the Russian Empire eastwards. And so therefore, Borodin depicts a sort of a caravan of people and horses and camels across the steppe lands of the Caucasus in Central Asia, and you have this sort of plodding hoofs of the horses and camels that start off, and you have these two themes, a Russian theme and an Eastern theme. The Russian theme is first with the strings, and then the very famous English horn solo with this more Eastern theme. And it's this kind of two cultures meeting. And it's amazing how in the music can represent something that's still entirely relevant today, that because eventually these two melodies are heard together contrapuntally, and they combine beautifully. And you think these two cultures, who are inevitably very different cultures, can combine beautifully. And so it's a sort of vision of hope for me that maybe our multicultural society can figure out how to function, and maybe we can learn something from Borodin.
Yeah, which would be fantastic. And that has happened a lot through the hundreds of years of music. Music from other cultures has been brought in, you know, even the Turkish music in Mozart's time, and Beethoven using the little Turkish march in the Ninth Symphony, and just a way of acknowledging, you know, other cultures, which is amazing. And so that kind of brings me to what you would like to do with the orchestra if you get the opportunity to be the new music director. I mean, what are some of the things you've been thinking about, some of the directions that you think you might take the orchestra in?
Well, some of the things that we've talked about in terms of integrating more female composers into the mix, integrating more lesser known composers. You know, we'll still accept them even if they're men. but also I think I'm slightly obsessed recently with the idea that orchestras are so relevant to our society today, that we're becoming more and more individualized with our individual iPhones, and everybody's got their own computer, and everything's tailored. We have the news that we read can be completely tailored to our own political views, and you know, it's all becoming a very individual thing. But actually, the orchestra to me is the epitome of the balance of individuality and the collective, because you bring all of this talent as an individual player, but when you come to the stage, when you come to the orchestral rehearsal, you have to swallow a certain amount of that individuality in favor of creating something larger than any of us can do on our own. Certainly I don't make any noise on my own. I just wave my arms and this magical sound comes out. But the idea of that collective and individuality really representing what we can be as a society. And I think that there are lots of ways that orchestras can show the incredible amount of skills that are involved in the orchestra that people can take back to their own lives. So if people can really learn to appreciate what goes on, I've done a lot of workshops, open rehearsals where we've sort of almost dissected the orchestra and had audience sit in on an orchestral rehearsal. And I point out various different things that you know, elements of communication between the violins and the double basses or something, you know, here's what the orchestra has to do at this point. Here's what the orchestra really needs. Actually, they're not taking me literally. They're really interpreting my gestures, all sorts of things that go on that often people don't really realize when they just come to the concert. Everything looks wonderfully polished when you come to the concert. You don't realize actually the high level of communication, leadership, and the collective skills that are going on. And I think those can be so relevant to our society, not just as an educational tool. Of course, they're fantastic. It's fantastic to use an orchestra as an educational tool for developing leadership in young people, but also what we can take back to everyday lives, everyday jobs. So I would love to see orchestras, and I would love to see, you know, if I were lucky enough to be hired, to see the New Haven Symphony really using the skills that they have on stage and reaching into their community and getting their community really invested in all of the skills and So this is sort of mutual benefit. It's not just a question of, oh, it's an enjoyable concert to come and hear the New Haven Symphony, but actually they're a really integral part of our community.
Yeah, that's what we're all hoping, I think, is having a way that, as you said, initially making the orchestra really relevant for the community. And Rebecca, it's been so interesting talking with you, and we're all really, really looking forward to hearing what you do with the orchestra. So thank you so much for taking some time to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very much looking forward to coming and hopefully to meeting as many community members as possible. I encourage people to get in touch with me on social media if you feel so inclined.